Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. And tonight, it's my pleasure to introduce to you two great scientists from UC Berkeley who have done a lot of research in an area that everybody is interested in and nobody has an answer to, which is, are we alone in the universe or not? So I'd like to introduce to you first Dan Wertheimer, and he's wearing white, by the way. In this debate, one is wearing white, one is wearing black, to make it clear whose side they're on, good guys and the bad guys. Dan's short bio is just great. Dan was in the Homebrew Computer Club with Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. Everyone in the Homebrew Club except Dan became filthy rich. So Dan has spent his life doing scientific research. So he's now the chief scientist of the SETI at Home project at UC Berkeley. SETI stands for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, right? Okay. Wertheimer's SETI at Home program has engaged over 8 million participants in citizen science. Wertheimer also directs the Center for Astronomy Signal Processing and Electronics Research, that's CASPER, and is associate director of the Berkeley Wireless Research Center. Before Berkeley, Wertheimer taught in the engineering and physics departments at San Francisco State University and was a visiting professor at Beijing Normal University, the University of St. Charles in Marseille, and Outvoz University in Budapest. He has taught at universities in Peru, Egypt, Ghana, Ethiopia, Zimbabwe, Uganda, and Kenya. How did your family like those trips? And Wertheimer is co-author of SETI 2020, editor of Bioastronomy, Molecules, Microbes, and Extraterrestrial Life, and Astronomical and Biochemical Origins, and the Search for Life in the Universe. Wow was right. So, our other great scientist today is Jeff Marcy. I'm sure you've read about some of his research in the New York Times. Jeff is one of the pioneers in the discovery and characterization of planets around other stars. His group discovered the first multiple planet system around another star. They found the first Saturn mass planet and the first Neptune mass planet. For those of you who are interested in why that's important, the mathematics that Jeff devised as a grad student, if I remember, as a grad student, has now been used by lots of people to try to figure out, you know, the little wobbles in the stars that we can see from far away, and that tells us what size planets they are. So as they get smaller and smaller, the math has to be better and better. That's my understanding. And so to say the first of the Saturn size, that's bigger, and then a Neptune size smaller, and right now he's looking for Earth-sized planets around other stars, which requires obviously a degree of sophistication in the mathematics of how many degrees, at least 100%, right, or 100% better. Given the size. So that's what Jeff has been doing. He holds the Alberts Chair in the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. He's an elected member of the National Academy of Sciences in 2002. He's the recipient of the Hong Kong Shaw Prize, 2005, shared with Michael Mayer, and the NASA Medal for Exceptional Scientific Achievement, 2003. He was named California Scientist of the Year in 2000. Please welcome two great scientists to debate, Are We Alone? And let me just explain the format for today is that each of the scientists will speak for about 15 minutes and then have a five-minute rebuttal for each side, and then we'll open it up to questions.
Thanks a lot, George. So I'm going to start off, and I wanted to start off by this is election season, so I thought it would be appropriate to discredit my opponent. In keeping with election season, this is why we should not trust Jeff. And this is a story where, in 1996, Jeff admitted that he is an alien. And so today he's going to say, well, he's not really an alien, because that would sort of admit that I'm right, that there are aliens. But anyway, here's proof that we shouldn't trust him. On a more serious note, I'm going to talk about kind of brief outline. First, I want to talk about something called the Drake equation, which is kind of how much life is there out in the universe and what are the different factors that are involved. I'm going to lay that out. And then I'm going to talk about this hypothesis called rare Earth, that Earth is really special and maybe unique, and what the pros and cons are there. Jeff and I will talk about that. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrials. We've been doing that for 50 years. I've been working on it for 30 years. Haven't bagged any aliens. And why is that? Why haven't we discovered them if they're out there? We'll talk a little bit about that. And then if there's time, we're going to talk about the Fermi paradox. And after Jeff and I are done with this kind of interchange, then we're going to open it up for questions. So let me start with the Drake equation. This is the equation that tells us, N on the left of the equation is the number of communicating civilizations in our Milky Way galaxy. The problem with this equation is that in order to calculate N, what we have to do is multiply all these numbers together. The problem with this equation is we have no idea what any of these numbers are. So it's a way to break up a big ignorance into lots of little ignorances. And so Jeff and I are going to be talking about some of the factors, and I want to kind of lay out how this equation works. It's kind of a whittling down process. You start with the number of stars in the Milky Way galaxy. There's a couple hundred billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. And then you ask, the next thing you ask is, well, what fraction of those stars have planets going around them? That's that P thing here. So how many, you want to get at how many planets are there? So we think planets are important for life. And then the next kind of factor is, once you have planets, how many of those planets have this E? E is environment. How many of them have the right environment for life? Do they have the right temperature? Do they have liquid water? Things that are needed for life. And then the next factor is, once you've got a nice planet that's got the right conditions, the next factor is, on what fraction of those good planets does life actually get started? And I'll talk a little bit about that. And then the next factor is, once you get life started, how often does you get intelligence? Do they evolve? Do they have big brains? Are they capable of communication? And then the next factor is, if you get intelligence, do they develop technology that we could use to communicate with them? That's what the C is. Communication technology. Do they have lasers? Do they have radio? Do they have navigational beacons? Do they have some way that we could find out about their civilization and talk to them? And then though that's that whittling down, again, you get the communicative technologies. And then the last factor, L, is how long do they live? After they invent radio and television and lasers, do they also invent nuclear weapons, biochemical weapons? Do they have some kind of civilization that allows them to live together in peace? We don't know how long they live. The Earth is about 5 billion years old. It's going to be around another few billion years. So if we can figure out how to learn to live together, we could be around for a long time. And some stars are 10 billion years old. So you could imagine very advanced civilizations out there, twice as old as the Earth. So let me talk a little bit more about the factors. So one of the factors is, are there planets around there? And my opponent, Jeff, is the world's expert on planets. And if you had asked Jeff and I 20 years ago, are there planets going around other stars? We say, well, we think so. But that's all changed thanks to Jeff and a couple other guys. In 1996, they discovered the first planets going around other stars. And that was the reason it took so long, is because they're little dinky things. You know, a million Earths could fit in the sun, and they don't give off much light. It's like looking for a firefly next to a searchlight. It's a very difficult thing. And Jeff invented this technique called the Doppler technique, where the planet goes around the star, and the star wiggles a little bit. And if you see a wiggling star, it doesn't wiggle much. It just moves at walking speed. If you detect that, and that's what Jeff figured out how to do, then you can infer, if a star is wiggling, you can infer from that wiggling star there must be a planet going around it and tugging on it. And that's what led to the first planets. And now here are these wiggles that Jeff did, and you can see a long wiggle that's out due to a planet that's going around slowly, and a fast wiggle that's going around quickly. And now Jeff and his colleagues have found hundreds, and now we found to combine 3,000 planets with this new thing called Kepler. Maybe Jeff will talk about this. Has found these planets, and some of them now are Earth-sized. The little dinky Earth-sized ones are the hardest ones to find. These blue dots here are Earth-sized planets. So I think Jeff and I will probably not going to argue about this. So I think we both now agree there's lots of planets out there. And we think there's a trillion planets in the Milky Way galaxy, more planets than there are stars. So planets, no problem. I don't think we're going to debate about that. Okay, so what about the conditions for life? And I think I would argue that that's pretty common too. And the reason I'm optimistic is because even in our own solar system, there are other places where you could have life. And this is one example. This is a moon going around Europa, which has liquid water going around it. This is cutaway view. And you see that underneath the ice here, it's about 50 miles thick of ice, is an ocean. And so there's liquid water at a nice temperature. Maybe there's something swimming around in there. We'd like to find out. We're trying to figure out how to drill through there or melt our way through or something. That's a long way off. We're not going to know if there's life on Europa. We don't have the technology right now, but it's something that NASA and others are starting to think about. Anyway, there's a few places in our own solar system with our own star where you have the right conditions for life. You have something at a nice temperature and you have liquid water. And so we think that the right conditions are kind of be ubiquitous. And we don't really understand the details of how life got started on Earth, but we're beginning to understand it may get started in something like this called the primordial soup. And people have done these experiments where they simulate the early conditions on Earth. They take a flask and they put in some methane and ammonia and water and hydrogen, and they put in sparks to simulate lightning. And you don't get gorillas crawling out of this thing, but you do get the basic building blocks of life, the amino acids that you and I are made of. So we're beginning to understand that process, and we even are beginning to understand how you can take those amino acids and in clay or in the cracks of ice, you can make these long chains of RNA and self-replicating molecules. So we don't completely understand, but the reason that we're optimistic is that life got started on Earth very, very quickly. It didn't take long, even though we don't understand the process, that just as soon as the Earth cooled down, basically life popped up. So we think that means it's probably pretty common. So I think Jeff and I probably don't have too much argument about simple life, getting started, just simple self-replicating things, single-celled things. I think we're going to agree on that, is that the universe is probably teeming with little kind of microscopic life that we think is going to be pretty easy. And so I want to talk a little bit about this Rare Earth book that Don Brownlee and Peter Ward wrote 12 years ago. And what they were arguing was that the Earth is incredibly unusual. They called it a Goldilocks planet, that there's a highly improbable set of circumstances, and there's no planet in the Milky Way that's like Earth, and therefore there's not going to be any life. They said that Earth is just the right distance from the sun, it's just the right distance from the center of the galaxy, that they argued that Earth has a giant moon, the biggest moon in the solar system, and that's what life needs, and we have a big planet, Jupiter, that's keeping asteroids from hitting us, and kind of all these kind of special circumstances that Earth is tilted 23.5 degrees, and if it were tilted more or less, that you wouldn't have life, and that everything is just right, and it's kind of finely tuned for life, and there's not going to be anything like that. And I think I don't agree with that. It's contrary to kind of the principles that we're learning about the universe, the principle of mediocrity, also called the Copernican principle. You might have heard of this, that we think maybe, we don't know this for sure, but we think the Earth is kind of a typical rocky planet in a normal planetary system located in an unexceptional region of a common barred spiral galaxy. That's kind of the principle of mediocrity and Copernican principle. And everything we've learned about the universe so far indicates that there's nothing really special about us. I'm sorry. So I want to talk a little bit more about this rare Earth hypothesis, that the assumptions are kind of extremely restrictive and unimaginative. That I think we don't really need life exactly like humans. So if you had a different kind of planet, that might be okay. Maybe you have different chemicals, different chemistries. On Earth, we even have examples of life that's very different. You might know about these extremophiles at the bottom of the ocean that live in temperatures that are above the boiling point of water. And you might there's radiation-tolerant creatures. There's creatures that live in Yellowstone in an incredible acid environment. So maybe you don't need to have these kind of situations that are exactly like what we have here. And I think that the rare Earth hypothesis is not really a hypothesis, and it's not even a prediction. It's merely a description of how life arose on this planet and a selection of factors that suits our case. You might have life that looks completely different. Here's an example of life, if you watch The Simpsons, that arose in a radiation environment next to the nuclear power plant. So one more slide about rare Earth. Well, I think what matters is not whether there's anything unusual about the Earth. There's going to be something idiosyncratic or unusual about every planet. And what matters is whether any of Earth's circumstances are not only unusual, but whether they are essential for complex life. So Earth may be unusual, but maybe there's other things that are maybe good or maybe even better. Maybe evolution happens faster on other planets because of the different circumstances. And so far, we haven't really seen anything that suggests that Earth conditions are the only conditions that would lead to intelligent life. So I think kind of a summary of that is that one particular path to intelligent life is improbable if you say it's only going to happen this way. But many paths are, there are many paths that lead to intelligent creatures. So we can have a variety of different kinds of planets. Maybe the tilt doesn't have to be exactly 23.5 degrees, but they also could lead to intelligent creatures. So the next thing I want to talk about is, if there are intelligent creatures, how are we going to find them? That's called SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And one of the ideas that we've had and other groups have had is that Earth is sending off radio and television out into space, and the early television shows, I Love Lucy, Ed Sullivan, left the Earth 50 years ago and have now gone past 10,000 stars. The nearby shows, The Simpsons, have gone past, the nearby stars have seen The Simpsons. And so this stuff is going out at the speed of light. And so maybe if other civilizations are out there, maybe they have something like television or radio or navigational beacons or radar signals or something that we could detect. And the Earth is getting brighter and brighter. This is 1940, 1950, and the Earth is brighter than the sun now at television frequencies, and we're pretty easy to detect if you're within 50 light years that you could detect this stuff. And this, we've even sent messages on purpose. So this is a message that was sent in 1974 from the world's most powerful transmitter, and it's a sequence of zeros and ones, and when you change the zeros and ones into black and white squares, you see kind of a picture, and it's got a human and a solar system and DNA and things like that. So we've sent messages on purpose, but most of the stuff that we send is accidental stuff. So we are looking for these signals, either an artifact of their technology that accidentally leaves their planet the way that television leaves their planet, or, if we're very lucky, maybe a deliberate signal, people that want to communicate with us, and we think a deliberate signal, they would make it easy to decode with language lessons and pictures, and they might know how to do it. They might have been in contact with thousands of other civilizations, and they've learned what works and what doesn't, and they tell us how to get on the galactic internet. We could learn a lot. Learn all their music, poetry, literature, science, medicine, how they survived through that difficult bottleneck when they had nuclear and biological weapons. So there's a lot we could gain. And the first civilization we contact is not going to be at our level. It's going to be very hard to find emerging civilizations like ours, I think. And it's going to be impossible to find them right now if they're primitive, more primitive than us, if they're still bacteria or trees. We don't know how to do that yet. So it's going to be hard to find them just where they just invented radio in a blink of an eye like we have. So it's more likely that the first civilization will be quite a bit more advanced. Now, I want to talk a little bit about why we've been doing this for a long time, looking for these radio signals and television signals. And Jeff, I think, is going to argue, Dan, you've looked for 30 years, you haven't found them, therefore they don't exist. So I want to kind of talk a little bit about anticipating his argument. And I think my argument is that we really don't know what we're doing. We're just getting in the game. SETI is kind of an emerging field. We've got a few ideas looking for radio or television. But the ideas have been changing over the last 200 years. So my guess is that because we've had all these different ideas and different we probably don't know exactly what other civilizations are doing. So one of the early ideas is Gauss suggested a couple hundred years ago that we should get in touch with ET by making big geometric objects on the planet, like a big right triangle of pine trees, maybe 3, 4, 5 miles on a side, big square of dirt, water, wheat, and ET would look down with their high-resolution telescope and see that we knew about the Pythagorean theorem, and then they get in touch with us. And then it was a clever idea, didn't get funded, but von Littron a couple hundred years ago suggested that we get in touch with ET by digging these ditches, circular ditches, 20 miles across, and fill a ditch with kerosene, use this match, not to scale, to make a bright ring of fire, a bright circle of light, and ET would see that, and then they get in touch with us. And I think these were all good ideas at the time. And today we think, that's really silly, and you're laughing. And so I think maybe today's ideas will be silly 200 years from now. But Charles Crowe suggested that we get in touch with the Martians by reflecting sunlight using mirrors, big mirrors, one where he lived, others to outline the shape of the Big Dipper, and that the Martians would see these bright lights. And this was not funded either. But the one that was funded was to send pornography into space. This was one, the plaque on the Pioneer 10 spacecraft with these naked people and very controversial. And this was directions to Earth so they could come and eat us and the path of the spacecraft. So I think it's naive to think that we know how best to search today, given that our history of changing SETI fashion. So I think, we're trying all these different ideas. optical, radio. We got a lot of different searches. I'll talk a little bit more about that if we have time. So I think to say, Dan, you're doing the right thing and you haven't found them, therefore they don't exist. I think we've only just begun this search and we're just learning how to do it. And the history is people have been doing this now, the early radio pioneers, Tesla, Marconi. They looked for signals that couldn't even get through the atmosphere. They thought they'd found ET, but now we know that there's no chance. So there's a lot of kind of dogma in SETI, and we're learning maybe how to do this, but I think that just because we haven't found them doesn't mean they don't exist. And I'm not the only guy that's doing a SETI program. There's a bunch of them, although we have the biggest group at Berkeley, and we have a lot of different things, but there's not that many people working on it. There's a dozen people on the whole planet looking for extraterrestrials. Okay, I think, how am I doing, George, on time? Where's our moderator? Sorry?
It's time to switch.
It's time to switch. Okay, I'm going to come back to this, and I'll tell you a little bit more about SETI when we come back.
Thanks, Dan. Let me start with a word about Dan Wertheimer to add to what George said to introduce him. In fact, Dan Wertheimer is doing the world's deepest, most sophisticated search for extraterrestrial intelligent life anywhere on the planet Earth. There are others who are, as he just mentioned, are searching for extraterrestrial intelligent life, but nobody is doing it with the electronic and information technology sophistication that Dan is, and he himself is the one who often designs the electronics that go at the back end of, say, a radio telescope that surveys the largest number of radio frequencies to search for intelligent life. So actually, Dan is being too modest. He really is the world leader by far, I would say, not just in the United States, but worldwide in searching for intelligent life. It's a lot of work. It takes a lot of technical knowledge, fundraising, going to the world's largest radio telescopes, and so on. Having said that, he's wrong. And what I'd like to do this evening is something that you won't read about, you won't see it in newspapers or on television very much anyway. I'm going to present two arguments, I think of them as two separate arguments, that suggest that technological beings in our Milky Way galaxy, despite its billions, maybe even a trillion planets, as Dan said, I'm going to suggest that technological beings are rare, maybe even absent, except for us humans, in the Milky Way galaxy. And again, this is an argument that you don't hear too much. It's not very popular to suggest that intelligent life might be rare. So I have some slides, and I'll start with a counterargument to what I will eventually argue. And Dan mentioned this, but I want to actually raise it myself. We have a new spaceborne telescope that NASA launched 3 years ago called Kepler. It is finding Earth-sized planets. It can find larger planets as well. And it finds these planets in the simplest possible way. It can't actually see the planets. The Kepler telescope can't. They're lost in the glare of the star. But the Kepler telescope can measure the brightnesses of stars and watch to see if they dim. And, of course, a star would dim as a planet crosses in front, blocking a little of the starlight, allowing us to detect that dimming of the star every time an Earth-like planet crosses in front in its orbit. And indeed, we are finding lots of planets are in the field of view 10 degrees by 10 degrees, which is something like 20 full moons by 20 full moons. We're surveying 150,000 stars. And here's one of the stars for which I thought you'd like to see the brightness measurements over the course of about a year, and you can see if you look carefully that the brightness of the star did indeed dim. Every once in a while there's a dimming, and I'll show you where those dimmings are right there. You see where the star has, there's noise, that's the jitter that you see, all the scatter of the points around the average brightness of one, but there are repeated dimmings, and that's due to a planet. This planet turns out to be about twice the diameter of the Earth. Kepler is doing a fantastic job of finding planets nearly the size of the Earth. Dan referred to this. It's a watershed moment in scientific history that we are finding literally not just hundreds but thousands of planets nearly the size of the Earth. Now, here's a plot that I'm going to come back to, so I wanted to introduce you to it. This is a plot of what we have found with the Kepler Spaceborne Telescope, searching for planets. On the vertical axis, if you don't mind my walking you through this, is the size of the planet in Earth units. You see a 1, a 4, a 10, and a 20. Those are the sizes of the planets relative to our Earth. And on the horizontal axis, you can see the orbital period down over here. 1 day, 4 days, 10 days, 40 days, 100 days, and over here at the far right, 365 days, like our own Earth takes to go around the sun. And so all the planets have an orbital period, some shorter than the Earth's orbital period of a year, some longer, and then they have a size. And what's glorious about this graph, and again, I'm going to come back to it, is the large number of planets between something like one Earth diameter. Let me see if I can point this out. I can't quite do it. But one Earth diameter. Is that a good bright green one? Yeah, that's good. And four Earth diameters. It's kind of hard to show it on the screen. Here's one. There's four. Look at all of these planets in between. We are indeed living in a universe, in a Milky Way galaxy with its 200 billion stars, that's teeming with planets roughly the size of the Earth. That's an extraordinarily positive note for life in our galaxy, and you might even say intelligent life. I'll come back to this slide in a few minutes. Now, let me jump right to the key issue. What about intelligent life in our Milky Way galaxy? Remind you, when you look up into the night sky, you're seeing a small fraction of our Milky Way galaxy with its 200 billion, with a B, stars. And many, if not most of those stars, harbor planets. We now know from the Kepler telescope and from other ventures. And so we do live in a Milky Way rich with stars, billions of stars. But the question really is whether our Milky Way galaxy is teeming with intelligent life as depicted in science fiction. So, here's the question. My voice is cracking up with emotion over the passion that we have about this question. So, our galaxy has 200 billion stars. A good fraction of them have planetary systems. Let's just make a wild guess to estimate something like 50 billion planetary systems. I think Dan correctly said that may mean there's something like a trillion planets. These 50 billion planetary systems may have something like 10 planets per system. That's a lot of throws of the biological dice. Every planet could plausibly spawn life. But the question isn't that. It's what fraction of those planetary systems spawn intelligent life, technological life. And there, as Dan mentioned, nobody knows the answer. Is life springing up around 1 in 10 of the planetary systems, 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000? Or is it, in the most pessimistic case, 1 in a million? Well, we don't know, but I don't think very many people would say that life is even a longer long shot than 1 in a million. So if you go with 1 in a million and you realize there are tens of billions of planetary systems, you immediately see that there should be thousands of advanced civilizations out there. And I do, in fact, mean advanced civilizations because, after all, some of those star systems sprang up not just hundreds of years ago, but thousands or even millions of years ago. Our sun is an averaged age star at 4.6 billion years. Some of those stars in the Milky Way are 7 or 8 or 9 billion years old. Everything I've said so far argues in favor of intelligent life in the Milky Way galaxy, a galaxy teeming with intelligent life. So you might say, well, why am I dressed in black? Well, the answer is coming up. Because if the galaxy is teeming with intelligent life, as depicted by Gene Roddenberry and the producers of Star Wars and Avatar, why is it that we don't see any evidence of these thousands or millions of spacecraft flying around, communicating with each other, surely by electromagnetic waves, radio waves, or others? Why don't we see them visiting the solar system? And so there's a problem. Where are they all if the darn galaxy is lousy with aliens? Did we perhaps overestimate the probability of intelligent life? They should have come here by chance. They should have just stumbled across the solar system. Why don't we see their robotic spacecraft with little alien Japanese cameras on board that can take pictures of us and are monitoring us? We don't see their transmissions. We don't see their spacecraft. We look on the moon. There are no obelisks. We look on Mars now with rovers. The rovers aren't running across little folks with antennae. We don't even see the crash-landed spacecraft that the aliens left a million years ago when they came to Mars and explored Mars like we are. But we don't see any evidence of their having done that. It's rather surprising. Why didn't they just leave some cameras and some transmitters on Mars or the moon, not to mention the Earth? And we would then be seeing the billions of years of exploration that they had done of Mars. So is it possible that we have been too optimistic about intelligent life, technological life in the galaxy? And now I want to come back to this slide. Yes, it's true there are lots of planets. Every dot you see there is a planet found by Kepler. But look more carefully at this graph. You see on the vertical axis, there is the number one. The size of the Earth is here on the lower left. But if you look carefully, planets roughly the size of the Earth or even smaller than the Earth, like the size of Mars, are in fact rare. Now, to be fair, as a member of the Kepler team, I can tell you we are still trying to figure out why planets the size of the Earth seem rare and why planets a little smaller than the Earth are rare compared to the planets twice or three or four times the size of the Earth. There is a suggestion yet to be verified that planets the size of the Earth, rocky worlds with water and continents like our Earth, may in fact be rare. So the rare Earth hypothesis in some surprising ways is supported by this windfall, this avalanche, this tsunami of planets. The paucity of Earths is striking and worrisome and maybe real. So the possibility that it's not just the rare Earth hypothesis in an abstract sense, but literally, is a plausible one. Now, here's another aspect of the rare Earth hypothesis that didn't appear in that book, the Brownlee book that Dan referred to. The Earth acquired its water, our Earth acquired its water by comets and asteroids slamming into the Earth and delivering the water that's a part of a comet. You see that on the upper left. On the upper right, you see how much water the Earth actually has. A droplet. 0.06% of the mass of the Earth is in the form of water. It fills the oceans, but not so much that the continents are covered with water. We have on the Earth a lucky amount of water, just enough to fill the sea bottoms, but not so much water that it covers the continents or Mount Everest, and not so little water that the water would have been soaked into the mantle, the interior of the Earth, sponged into the interior, leaving the surface a dry desert. Now, you might say, well, come on. What are the chances that our Earth could have been a desert world? That just doesn't seem plausible. Well, look at the two planets on either side of us, Venus and Mars. Not a droplet of water on either one of our two sister terrestrial planets. So the Earth is the only one with liquid water on the surface, and we know how important liquid water is for life, at least life as we know it. Now, on the other hand, what if the Earth had acquired too much water, say 50% more or a factor of two more water? Why not? The Earth could have gotten two droplets worth of water instead of one droplet worth of water. In that case, the water on the planet Earth would have covered the continents. Mount Everest maybe would have poked up if we're lucky. But we would be living on a planet that is like a bad Kevin Costner film. And you just, you know how, if you saw that movie, you know how bad it would be if we lived on a water world. There would literally, to be serious, there could well be fish, there could be birds, there could even be marine mammals with social intelligence. But could we have developed electronics, computers, rockets, never mind music and the arts, if we lived in a water world? It's hard to picture us as a technological species developing on a water world. Yes, it's not impossible, and I can argue how it might, maybe, sort of, kind of happen. But a desert world and a water world are not that far-fetched, and the planets in our own solar system give us some pause. Another possible reason that intelligent life might be rare in the galaxy is that maybe Darwinian evolution does not lead inexorably, like a vector, toward intelligence. In fact, if you look at the fossil record, species throughout time did not get smarter. You can look at almost any species. They simply didn't get bigger cranial sizes over the course of their development. One of the many examples are the reptiles. They ruled the earth, the dinosaurs did, for 200 million years, much longer than we humans have been around. We Homo sapiens have been around for a few tens of thousands of years. The dinosaurs had 200 million years for each mother dinosaur to lay her eggs and hope that her baby dinosaurs would be smarter than the average dinosaur and would therefore outcompete the other dinosaurs for resources and live on to pass on the genes of that baby dinosaur to the next generation of dinosaurs. If there had been even the slightest advantage to a little bit of extra intelligence, a higher IQ, then those dinosaurs would have passed on their genes and the cranial sizes of dinosaurs would have gotten a little larger every century, every thousand years. But it didn't happen. Whenever the paleontologists dig up the bones of a dinosaur, they never find a chessboard, a violin, never mind a computer. And so it's interesting to see how the brains didn't really develop. And here you see the walnut-sized brains of the smartest of the dinosaurs. They stayed with brain sizes no larger than those of chickens. And so I'll just remind you that, of course, there are many other examples. Flies don't get smarter. Even our mammals on the earth don't get smarter. And indeed, there are species that have no brains at all. For hundreds of millions of years, have survived perfectly well against the elements, like the jellies, and the jellies are doing perfectly well, thank you very much, without any intelligence. So this is a sign that Darwinian evolution does not lead inexorably to intelligent life. And then finally, I'd like to echo the last term that Dan mentioned in his Drake equation. What is the lifetime, the typical lifetime of an advanced civilization? Well, we don't know, but we know that we humans are confronted with a challenge of surviving our own nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, biological weapons, and we are toying with our own global environment. And so when you develop technology, you threaten your own existence. How many centuries can you go by throwing the dice about your own existence? Maybe intelligent life is common, but it only lasts a few hundred or thousands of years, and that might leave the galaxy barren, deserted, not because intelligent life is intrinsically a rare occurrence, but because it only lasts for a flicker of time out of the cosmic lifetime. So I'll finish by saying that technological life might be rare for the two reasons that I mentioned. First of all, we don't see any evidence of the aliens. If the galaxy were teeming with life, why don't we see evidence? And secondly, it's possible that we have an explanation. The explanation would be truly habitable worlds might be rare, certainly one suitable for intelligent life. The water issue, evolution may not lead to big brains, and technology is self-destructive. And so I think I would finish by saying the Earth is perhaps indeed a precious planet. We're seeing lots of planets nearly the size of the Earth, but true Earth twins may be rare. Water and continents as a combination on a planet might be rare. And intelligent may simply not arise very commonly on planets. Maybe it's one in a million or even a longer shot than that. I do think, as Dan mentioned, I agree, microbial life is common. But I think it's possible that technological life is more precious. We humans may be a rare occurrence in the Milky Way galaxy, a precious natural commodity, you might say. So I'll stop there, and I think now we're going to allow Dan to...
I'm going to tell you why Jeff is completely wrong. So I wanted to just argue a few of the points that Jeff made. So one is that Jeff said there's a small number of Earth-sized planets, and that's true. He hasn't discovered that many, but he has discovered 100 kind of Earth-sized planets. It's kind of amazing, and it's just incredible. I'm excited about that. And just remember that he's only looked at 150,000 stars with Kepler. So if we you know, there's more than 150 a billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. So if we extrapolate on Jeff's number, that's going to mean there's millions of these little dinky planets in the Milky Way, just based on the number that he's found so far of the number that he's looked at. Just extrapolate, there's you know, 100 million of these little planets in the Milky Way. And there's billions of other galaxies as well. That's just our galaxy. So I don't buy this small argument, the small planets. And I think also there are probably lots of small planets that Jeff hasn't detected yet, because they're really hard. The small planets are the hardest ones. That's Jeff spent, you know, years of his life trying to find these little dinky things, the big ones like Jupiter. So I think there's some missing ones there that they just can't find yet. Anyway, there's plenty of little planets. So the other thing that Jeff was talking about is he was saying that the right amount of water is rare. You could have maybe too much water, too little water, but Earth is kind of just right. And I think that's bogus as well, because we know that just even in our own solar system, right in our own neighborhood, Mars had liquid water on its surface. You know, there used to be, you can see these what people used to call canals, but they're really just kind of riverbeds. Mars had the right conditions, exactly the kind of conditions that Jeff was arguing don't exist. And that's just in our own solar system. And there are a few other places in our solar system I pointed out that you could have the right conditions. So if it happens in our own solar system, then you know, it's bound to happen other places. So, okay, now another argument that Jeff was talking about was, how often do you get intelligence? And that there are evolutionary pressures that, I think there are different kind of evolutionary pressures on different kinds of places on this planet and other planets. And it is true that you don't have to be smart to succeed, and you can, you know, maybe if you're fast, that's a really good for your evolutionary, or if you're strong, that can, you know, be, and that can lead to success, or there's lots of ways to do it, strong or radiation hard, a fast swimmer, good camouflage. There's lots of ways to succeed in life, but I think there are going to be some evolutionary niches on this planet and other planets where it's advantageous to be smart, where, you know, if you want to hunt creatures, or that takes intelligence. So there are going to be some evolutionary pressure in some places on planets where smart is the thing that's going to lead to success. Not always. The other creatures are very successful. Jeff was talking about the jellyfish. And my kind of proof of that is that there are several intelligent creatures here on Earth. The dolphins that have brains that are bigger than ours. The chimps have big brains. And I think if we get wiped out somehow, and we can talk about that, then the chimps will evolve and become, you know, it won't take long before we're replaced with intelligent creatures, as least or more intelligent than we are. So I think there are selection effects that lead to intelligence, but it's absolutely true that there are other ways to succeed in life besides being intelligent. But so the other thing that Jeff was talking about is how long do civilizations live? And it is true that we could blow ourselves up, and we, you know, that we're developing that technology, and we can talk about and who gets elected in November. But I think that it is true that some civilizations may blow themselves up, but some are going to figure this thing out and figure out how to live together and stop killing each other, and they're going to use their technology for good things. And not so. I think Jeff's right, but I would say not all civilizations are going to do that. And, you know, we have, I don't know, 50-50 chance, and that means that if there's a billion civilizations, 500 million of them are going to succeed and the others won't. And even if we don't succeed, if we blow ourselves up, it's not going to be long before, you know, we're not going to wipe out everything on Earth. So it won't take long for life to come, for intelligent life to come back. So I think eventually you get a civilization that is successful. So I think we got a bottleneck to go through, but once you get through that bottleneck and maybe discovering other civilizations and talking to them might allow us to figure out how to do that. So I think Jeff is partly right, but he's not right about all cases. I would just say that, yes, some blow themselves up, some don't. Let's see. I think do I have a little more time? I want to talk a little bit about SETI. Oh, actually, before I do that, Jeff and I have done this one time before, and it's you can look at it on the website. It's called SETI.berkeley.edu, or just Google SETI, and you can find this debate, and you can vote on who you think won, and you should vote for me and vote often. And by the way, I am leading 2-1 right now. But no pressure. So, okay, Jeff talked about this thing called the Fermi paradox. And, maybe before I want to tell you a little bit more about SETI. We use the biggest telescope on the planet.
Switch.
It's this Arecibo dish. We think the signals are going to be weak. And how much more time do I have, George?
-1 minute.
All right. I'm not going to tell you about SETI, but if you go to the website, you can learn how to help us. And you can install. I know that some of you are doing this. You can install the SETI home screensaver. Everybody gets a piece of data from the world's largest telescope. And I hope you all go home tonight and install this thing on your computer, SETI at home, and help us. Everybody, and you can, if you find ET, you find that your computer will be looking for these radio signals. If you find ET, you get the Nobel Prize. But you have to share it. You have to share it with Jeff and me. This is. I want a little more further proof. We are doing this projects in SETI, but Jeff is also doing SETI. He's got a project at the world's largest optical telescope looking for laser signals from ET. So what he's telling you is complete crap, because if he thought there was ET, if you think there was no extraterrestrials, why would he be doing this SETI stuff? Okay, so then finally, we got a lot of exciting stuff ahead of us. Here's a kind of quick summary. No ET so far. Still working on it. We got a long ways to go, so don't hold your breath. And I'm going to skip the Fermi paradox. We can come back to that if people are interested. But I want to tell you a little bit about the people that help us. They run the SETI home screensavers. They will help us in a lot of different ways. They use their computers. We built the largest supercomputer on the planet, thanks to all the volunteers, 8 million of them around the world. George talked about that. You can sign up, help us, and you can help us in lots of different ways, and a lot of people help us not by just using their computer, but they send in poetry, literature, they help write the code. It's a big open source project. There's a lot of ways that people contribute. They send in money, that's really nice, it keeps the students going, and they send in haikus. And there are thousands of haikus that people have sent in. I'm just going to read you two of them. Searching for life, answers are revealed about ourselves. That's Paula Cook at Duke University. And the last haiku that I want to read you by one of these SETI at home volunteers that helps us search for ET by Dan Seidner. 1 million earthlings bounded by optimism leave their PCs on. Thank you.
That's great. And first I'd like to thank both Jeff and Dan for a great debate into this idea of are we alone or not here at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. And Jeff has generously donated his rebuttal time to questions from the audience. So I have one quick statistical question for you. You have the 2,300 exoplanets, and the distribution tends towards the smaller planets have faster periods, 1 to 4 or 5. Isn't that mathematically logical? Because the smaller planets harder to detect it with a 365 or a 500 day period, it would be much harder to find. And because I saw the spread go out. The bigger the planet, the more there were with longer periods, and so maybe it's just that we can't technologically see them.
Yeah, it's a very exciting moment, frankly, in human history. We are, as you suggest, at the brink of being able to detect Earth-sized planets in Earth-like orbits. Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out, they are the most difficult to find. They're small, and they only cross in front of their star once per year or so. And so they cross in front of the star only rarely, and they only dim the star by a small amount. And for both of those reasons, we are very happy that NASA is continuing to fund the Kepler spacecraft for another 4 years, maybe another 8 years, and indeed the main quarry in the hunt are these Earth-like planets in Earth-like orbits. And you're right, they may be rare at the moment, in part because we have to keep gathering more data.
Right. Good. Okay.
I wish you could have talked longer anyway. Thank you. I don't think the word intelligence and technology, it's not the same thing. Just because they don't have electronic technology doesn't mean they're not intelligent.
Yes.
Also, there's been, I think, too much talk of just this galaxy. There's tons of galaxies, so, you know, there very well, I think, is intelligent life, and if not in this one, in others. And I don't understand why it has. They have to be Earth size. I mean, there could be intelligent beings on other size planets, I think. And also, you know, they may not. For some kind of intelligent beings to be, they may have different forms, different bodies, and they may not then need the conditions that we have on Earth.
So thank you for arguing on my points. I pretty much agree with you, and I think that you're absolutely right. Intelligence and technology are not the same, and you can imagine very advanced civilizations that are into literature and poetry and music, and they're not, you know, maybe they've spent their technological phase and they're communicating. They did that, and now they're more introspective, and maybe we'll go that way. And so I have here a little slide about that. Maybe they're poets and not explorers. So.
I have a question for Professor Marcy. You argue that if a world was covered with water, a high civilization couldn't evolve. It just happens about 50 years ago, I attended an American Physical Society meeting at which somebody gave a paper about what he called wiggle worms. And his question was, suppose you had these little worms that lived in the mud at the bottom of a water body,
right.
And they couldn't see. In fact, their main sense was an ability to detect the pH in the water around
right.
them.
Right.
Would they eventually, perhaps not in the same water, discover the same laws of nature that we discovered? And he argued, yes, that there was a way that that could be done.
Yeah. No, the reason I think that's unlikely, and I completely agree, as I alluded, there could be fish, birds, and marine mammals with social intelligence, maybe even higher social intelligence than we have, communities that take care of each other and love each other, care for their young, care for their community. The question is, can you develop technology? This gets back to the previous question. Intelligence, yes. Technology, and especially electronics, in the water, challenging. Not impossible, by the way, but developing computers on a water world is an extra leap of challenge, which, you know, adds to the difficulty.
They couldn't build boats.
They would have to have wood. And they would, and the way this would work, just to carry your idea further. The idea would be on a water world, of which I think the universe is indeed teeming, there would have to be seaweed rafts, seaweed flotillas, in which the advanced species essentially evolve on those seaweed rafts, serving as the continents.
I'm curious as to, could Kepler detect Earth? If it were on another star
easily.
System.
That's exactly what Kepler is designed to do. Kepler can detect Earth-sized planets in Earth-like orbits.
Including with the rest of the solar system interfering?
Absolutely, yeah, because you would see the Earth cross every year, dimming the star. If you're lucky, you would see the inner planets like Venus and Mercury cross in front and dim the sun as well, and you would detect all of those planets with no trouble.
Let me just add to a little bit about what Jeff said. So if the orientation is right and the planet gets in front of the star, then you can do exactly what Jeff is talking about. But if it's going around this way, it doesn't get in front of the star. So not you don't detect them all, but if they're in the right plane, if the geometry is right, then you can get them.
I'm wondering about your graph.
Yeah, and in the graphics that I showed, we detect what we detect. Any planets that are in a tilted orbit so that the planets don't cross in front of the star, we don't find them. We're blind.
If we put aside a minute that one way to detect ET is through radio waves and things like that, one reason we've never been visited is if you believe that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, it would take hundreds of human lifetimes just to go from Alpha Centauri or something.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think one argument that actually is a mitigation, an amelioration of issues that Dan raised and that I raised is maybe we don't see the robotic spacecraft buzzing around our solar system because it's energetically too expensive and it takes too much time for them to travel here. So the fact that Mars is barren is a sign, and this is a little bit poignant. The fact that Mars is barren might not indeed be a sign that the intelligent species aren't out there, but that interstellar travel is simply too difficult. So that, again, Star Wars and Star Trek, in effect, are not correct, but not because the aliens aren't out there. It's just that interstellar travel is just too expensive and takes too long.
Two things. One, you've titillated us about the Fermi paradox, and I'd enjoy hearing a little bit about that. The second question, largely for Dan, is the distinction between intelligent civilizations and technological civilizations that it rather seems to me that a huge problem is the problem of something like the hand and the likelihood of that developing. I mean, we can have really intelligent porpoises, really intelligent elephants, but we don't necessarily have a species that originated up in the trees and came down to Earth and happens to have something that's able to grip and, you know,
right.
And
you
so
need
forth.
Opposable thumbs, you so, need fire. There's a lot of things you need.
And
for
that seems extraordinarily improbable, but, you know, I wonder what your thinking is about that.
Well, I just got a vote, I want to
yeah,
say.
Right. You know, a lot of this fancy stuff happened independently on parallel paths on Earth, and there are lots of evolution of eyes and opposable thumbs. And so I think, you know, if it happened completely independently on Earth, but I do agree that I think we both agree that there's simple life is common, but this advanced life and especially technology, I think is your argument, you know, where they have fire, they have opposable thumbs, they can build radio telescopes or something. So I think there are other ways that we might be able to detect primitive life, or that we don't know how to do this now, but eventually we'll have telescopes in space that could look and see if there's oxygen in the atmosphere, and that would tell you if there's photosynthesis, tell you if there's plants or trees or something like that. Eventually we can use our sun as a gravitational lens, make the telescope the size of the sun, we could read license plates on a distant planet. We don't know how to do that now, but eventually Earthlings will be able to look for these non-technological life forms.
We have time for maybe two more questions.
Professor Marcy, I have a question for you. Given your skepticism, do you think that SETI is a waste of time and money?
And I'm so delighted. Let me repeat what George said in the introduction and Dan mentioned. I am fortunate to be the SETI professor at UC Berkeley, and I'm obligated, and happily so, to carry out searches for extraterrestrial intelligent life in our galaxy and even elsewhere in the universe. And the reason is very simple, that while I am pessimistic, and I think that the density, the number of intelligent civilizations per cubic mega light year is a low density. There are few of us out there. There are surely intelligent life forms out in the universe. There's a shocker given my black clothing. And the reason is, as was already stated, Our Milky Way galaxy has 200 billion stars, but there are hundreds of billions of galaxies. There are simply too many throws of the biological dice to not have intelligent life somewhere. Now, having said that, the downer is, how far away are they? How far away is the nearest intelligent civilization? Is it 20 light years, 100 light years, 1,000, 1,000,000 light years? And that's really the question here. Is the galaxy teeming with life, or is intelligent technological life a rarity? But I think we should be searching, because we'll never know the answer if people don't look.
Can I just add to that? I think this question, are we alone, is a question that a lot of people are interested in. It's super cheap. You know, it's way less than a penny a person. And so it's a profound question. Either way, it's interesting. If we are alone in the universe or in the Milky Way galaxy, that makes life incredibly precious, and we better take damn good care of the life here on our planet. And if the universe is teeming with life, we could learn from these advanced civilizations. That's really profound. Either way, I think it's interesting. So you got to, the only way we're going to find out is to do these kind of, and it's a modest kind of thing, and it's a lot of volunteers and students. And it's a really exciting time right now. You know, people have been asking this question, are we alone, for thousands of years, and our generation is really the first generation that has a chance of answering this question.
Should we be practicing communicating with the animals that we know are on the planet? Because it's unlikely that they'll be speaking English. Is there anything going on like that that's attempting? I mean, I know that there are something.
Yeah, there are people working on ways that we could communicate without having pre-communication, you know, pictures or mathematics. And people think the mathematics and science is universal. The universe is kind of the same everywhere, is what we've learned. And so they will understand physics and math, and we can start with that. And pictures we think are a good way. And people are working on these kind of languages. There's a famous one called Linkos. And I think that's going to work if it's deliberate communication. If they want to communicate with us, then they'll know what works and what doesn't. And so I think we have a good chance of communicating with civilization. But I think if it's just a leakage signal, if it's a navigational beacon or radar, or even if it's television, we're not going to just leaks off their signal the way we, then I think we're not going to be able to decode it. Well, so we'll know they're out there, but we're not going to figure out much about their civilization. It's still interesting.
Okay, one last question.
I was wondering, you mentioned an ant that stumbles into the kitchen eventually. That ant only sees in two dimensions. Length and width, and we only see in three dimensions. We're probably surrounded by teeming of light, just as the ant is not aware of our existence. Mm-hmm. We are not aware of any other existence, but our brain and our intuition far exceeds our monkey brain and monkey sight.
So I think what you're hypothesizing is some kind of new physics that may be faster than light travel or something that we don't understand. And I think we probably don't know all there is to know about physics and science, and there may be indeed something that goes faster than light, or some kind of some we just don't understand. But I think you got to do what you know how to do. And if you told Christopher Columbus 500 years ago, you know, if you sail for India and look for these spices, just wait 500 years. There'll be airplanes. That'll make your job a lot easier. That, you know, that's true. And maybe 500 years from now, we know about some better way to do it besides radio or television or lasers. But Columbus found something interesting, and I think we could too. But you're absolutely right. There could be some kind of new physics, and maybe in 500 years, everybody's going to laugh at what Jeff and I are doing.
Well, in your equation about, you know, the possibility of finding life, there was no element of that it would be an advantage to us versus a disadvantage to us to meet this advanced civilization. Not certainly, you know, I mean, at least the movies from Hollywood tend to be on the pessimistic side there too, because other species tend to want food or something. So I don't know, how do you come down on that? Do you think that, obviously you would think that it's an advantage to us, everything that you said. Do you think it would be a disadvantage to us, Jeff?
I think an interesting psychological issue is how we perceive the threat of the advanced civilizations. And the irony is, we humans know that when we ourselves have explored the surface of the Earth, traveled to another island or another continent, we've often done damage. And so the irony is when we confer upon our extraterrestrial friends that same sort of damaging behavior, we're really reflecting on our own behavior. And I think from that vantage point, we have a lot to gain, as Dan mentioned, by communicating with the extraterrestrial intelligent life. They may be able to offer us solutions to our social problems here on the Earth.
That's great. It reminds me of... you go ahead, Dan.
Well, this question of are we in trouble if we find ET? I think it's a really interesting question. This question touches on this thing called active SETI. Some people think that Earthlings should deliberately transmit message out there. We've been listening for a while. We haven't heard. So let's transmit. And I'm very much, and almost everybody in the SETI community thinks that that is a mistake, that we should not. We're an emerging civilization. We just discovered radio 100 years ago. We don't know what's out there. Let's do a passive search. Let's listen and find out what's out there. And then we could, you know, if we find something interesting, then we should decide as a whole society. It shouldn't be just up to Jeff and me whether we transmit or something like that. So I think we should just listen, but even listening has dangers because I can imagine, I think in most scenarios it's fine. We got a lot to learn. We could learn a lot. But I think if there is, if we do learn some new technology from an advanced civilization, even just by listening, there are risks involved in that because technology, as you know, can be used for good or evil. You can use radiation to cure people or kill people. And so I think we have to, if we do learn something new, we better be careful about how we use it.
That's great. And as Jeff was saying, it just reminded me of one of the pithiest descriptions of Hollywood. Hollywood, it was in The Economist about a decade ago or so. Hollywood takes our dreams and our nightmares and gives them back to us with better bodies and bigger budgets. And so this is the end of another event of the Commonwealth Club, and it's 110 years of enlightened discussion. Thanks a lot, Jeff and Dan.